I can't remember exactly where we ended up, where we, I can't remember exactly the kata. I know it was important. If any of you could remember, maybe if we go up the chat, we can see where we were last week. Yeah. Oh, you're talking about Bhaktisiddhanta, that's right. Okay. And then we talked about what? We talked about other movements, right? Oh, yeah, how you deal with other movements. Did we? I think we. Anyway, if you have any questions, ask. I think we had discussed a little bit about other movements and other organizations, but I could say a few things, and if anybody wants to add their experience or ask questions. But I went on a website yesterday, so I was just, okay, I want to talk about something. This is very interesting. I went on a website yesterday. I forgot the name of the website. I think it might have been called Getting Free of ISKCON or something like that. Something like that. But anyway, that was the theme of the website. And oftentimes I like to hear from devotees who are disenfranchised with ISKCON just to see why and just to prevent it from happening for those who are in ISKCON and what they've gone through and so forth. I wasn't looking for this site, I was looking for something else and it just came up in the Google search. And I can't really tell where it's coming from and who's writing it. I think a lot of it must be coming from the first generation of second generation devotees. That means the children of devotees who were born in the 70s, because they had a difficult time because our gurukuls were not well run, to say the least. A lot of bad things happened to them. But anyway, I'm just talking about how bad ISKCON is and this and that, and being critical of leaders. And my first thought is, of course, always when I read these things, is why do you want to spend your time with such negative things? You know, move on with your life, okay? Something bad may have happened, or you don't like it, but why would you want to have a whole website? I think probably they want to have a website to pull other people out of ISKCON because they feel that's a service and they feel ISKCON is not what Prabhupada wanted or whatever. But some of the people who contributed were actually criticizing Prabhupada. I mean, this is criticizing ISKCON leaders, criticizing ISKCON, what it has done. So where's it logically taking someone? So they began criticizing Prabhupada for what seemed to be politically incorrect statements or racist statements, or for saying things which in their estimation were the catalyst for faults or problems or extreme or abuse in ISKCON. So it was quite interesting to see that progression. Not everyone was talking about that, but by listening to them speak against ISKCON, even before I read direct blasphemy of Prabhupada, of course it was, you know, it was covered a little bit, so it didn't look exactly like it, but it at the same time it didn't look like it wasn't. And so I was thinking, okay, this is interesting because you start, ISKCON is Prabhupada's movement. Okay, maybe it's not run exactly the way it was during Prabhupada's time. Maybe there are problems, maybe there were problems, but on this site and similar sites, nobody says anything about what's going on properly. I mean, obviously, everything in any organization can't be 100% bad, and every person can't be 100% bad. So you don't get any out of that. Okay, well let's look at what's bad, let's look at what's good. So it's a very negative attitude, and after I was reading it, I was thinking that if someone is absorbed solely in the bad, coming to the point where they would actually criticize Prabhupada, then quite a disturbed person. But I began reflecting on it afterwards, and I was thinking it's very interesting because if someone is highly critical of ISKCON, that's one thing. If you're a well-wisher, like you can be critical. You can be objectively critical and say, well, what happened was bad or what happened was wrong. We need to improve this. This isn't good. Okay, that doesn't mean you hate the devotee and you hate everybody and you begin criticizing everything that does in ISKCON. That means you recognize here's a problem. And so we don't want to just be, okay, we should only glorify devotees. We shouldn't say anything bad. If somebody is abused or somebody is mistreated, we have to say this is not right. If objectively it's not right and everyone can see that. So that's different. Okay, we want to improve the organization. We see there's a problem. So we talk about it. This is a problem. We can go to our temple president. We can go to GBC. We can go to senior devotees and say, there's a problem here. We need to discuss this. This is not good. Okay, that's one thing. You don't get on the internet and start telling everybody that this is a problem. It's not good. You might do that in a positive way. Say, we need to help this situation. We need counselors. We need funding. Okay. But if it's just criticism without a heart to help, then what is ISKCON? ISKCON is the movement Prabhupada started. So indirectly, even if you don't directly criticize Prabhupada and you're criticizing ISKCON, indirectly, in some way, if your criticism is not done with a real concern that we would like to see things better, if it's just, as we'll find on some sites, if it's just very what I would call below the belt, on the verge of blasphemy, or just clear blasphemy, then to criticize ISKCON is, in that sense, to criticize Prabhupada. If it's done with vengeance, if it's done to say there are no devotees, there's no purity, everything's impure, which is, there may be some devotees who are not really devotees, who don't act like devotees, who don't have a heart of a devotee. We see that. We're all conditioned souls. And some people have become leaders and misuse that position. Okay, we understand that. We've had a past where this has happened. So we don't deny that. But to deny that there's purity within the organization today, that everything's bad, then because ISKCON is Prabhupada's movement, then basically you're criticizing Prabhupada. I mean, you may not feel like you are, but you have to say to some degree that's a criticism. In some way you're criticizing Prabhupada, that he doesn't have one disciple. He couldn't make any, Prabhupada doesn't have one disciple. Only good disciples are outside of ISKCON. He doesn't have one good disciple. Everything is bad. So I think we need to be careful about that. And so as I was reading this, I was thinking, oh, okay, now we see, criticize everyone in ISKCON, criticize everything in ISKCON, criticize everyone in ISKCON. There's nobody good, everyone's bad, or most everyone is bad. So where does that logically take you? Then it's not a far jump to start criticizing Prabhupada. And even if you don't directly criticize Prabhupada, you're criticizing his devotees. Does that make him happy? His devotees, his movement, in a sense, is not different from him. So by criticizing them, you're criticizing him. Just as when you criticize a devotee, it's an offense to the holy name because the devotee is not different from Krishna. Krishna's offended. It's the same idea. So then I began thinking of something, and I don't know if all of you are aware of this. Krishna Kirtan would know. But this is kind of heavy. Now, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we know, is an eternal associate of Krishna, whose eternal form is as a manjari, and he descended on this planet, being prayed for by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, to help Bhaktivinoda Thakur spread Krishna consciousness. Bhaktivinoda Thakur prayed for a ray of Vishnu. Please send. Because Bhaktivinoda Thakur had started to preach Krishna consciousness to people outside Vedic culture, outside Vaishnav culture, meaning non-Vaishnavas. And he wanted it spread to the West, and he prayed, please send somebody who would come and help me with this. And he had many sons and daughters, but it became obvious to him that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was sent from the spiritual world to him to help him. And in a dream, one of his disciples, somehow or other in a dream, understood Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's constitutional position, his swarup as Nayana Manjari. And he asked him, "Is this who you are?" And Bhaktisiddhanta laughed and said, "Yes." I don't know how he knew that, but in the dream it was revealed. So, the reason I'm telling you all of this is that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had disciples who rejected him, who did not agree with what he was teaching, who were being influenced by other philosophies and other disciplic lines and successions and ways of thinking and doing things. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was a revolutionary. And so he broke out of the mold in order that Krishna consciousness could reach more people. And some disciples didn't agree and they left or turned against him. Now, isn't that interesting? Now, are we seeing that today? Yeah, some of these websites, it's coming to that. This website came to that point. They were attributing what we could say as moral transgressions in ISKCON, which have harmed devotees psychologically or even physically, as being caused by what Prabhupada taught, and therefore he's the ultimate person to blame. So it's come to that point. And of course, some people early on in the movement did leave Prabhupada and went to take shelter of other gurus in Radhakund or other places. So we did see some rejection. Most rejection for devotees is just they fall into Maya or they become Christians again or something. But these people were rejecting Bhaktisiddhanta without externally giving up the practice or identification of a Vaishnava, but disagreeing with him. So I think we need to be extremely careful in how we deal with devotees and ISKCON when we see things which we feel are not right and we feel need improvement, or we see things which are really bad or wrong. We need to be very, very careful in how we relate to devotees. And I was having a nice conversation with Premanjali, she's the editor, and I was saying something which I feel is important. And I want to preface it by some feedback. I'll answer your question, Bell, in a little bit. I want to preface it by some feedback that I've gotten in for some of the classes I've given. And when I get the feedback, it should make me happy, but it makes me extremely sad. And Venerati, you told me this also. I believe you told me this. As you know, in many of the classes I give, I try to express our philosophy in a way that relates to the practicalities of our life, very honestly, not like paint a picture, an optimistic picture, when I know devotees are struggling with certain anarthas, ones that we all struggle with. So in my classes, I'm very straight about it. I kind of what could you say I do? I just talk about what's real, what the struggles we're all going through. I talk about how we think. You know, we all look like everything's lovey-dovey and everything's perfect and, you know, like that. But we know in our hearts and minds, we don't always think like we act or like we look. So I talk about those things. And I also sometimes talk about what we could call dysfunctions. I don't know if that's a good word, but it's a good enough word for this discussion. So sometimes I talk about dysfunctions in individuals' lives or the lives of organizations within ISKCON, or managerial dysfunction, or a dysfunction in a temple. Now, it doesn't mean the whole temple's dysfunctional. It may be dysfunction in a certain leader's the way he or she relates to devotees. Maybe a department. It may be an ashram. Maybe an ashram's not well supervised. And when I say dysfunction, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person in charge of something is a bad person or a maladjusted or weird person or doesn't understand the philosophy. It just means that it's less than what it should be. It's not entirely normal, in my estimation. And so sometimes I talk about these things just so we know what's normal. I talk about how to deal with these things, talk about how to understand these things, how not to pretend that they don't exist, and how when you see them, to recognize, okay, there's two roads you can take, and, you know, 12 devotees may be going this way, 3 may be going that way, but you have to understand through the philosophy and recognize what's right and what's wrong in a way that you don't, you just clarify it for your own service and your own sadhana, not in a way that you criticize anybody. So I was talking to Premanjali and I was saying, and I think maybe I remember this happening also when I was in Monterey with Arthur Margarito or Silvai or maybe some others, that I give a class and people would come and say, thank you for giving that class, we needed to hear that. And I felt, oh, there's two things people would say. One is, thank you for giving the class, we needed to hear that, and I feel the same way. Usually that comes from an older devotee. I felt the same way, and they would say, but nobody talks about it, and I think we should talk about it, it's important. So that didn't make me sad, that makes me happy that they were appreciating it. But what made me sad is when some devotees would say, I feel the same way, but I didn't know if it was right, I was afraid to say it, I thought that I was in my... In other words, and most of the devotees who say that, interestingly, are young devotees who have not been in ISKCON a long time, but just felt that sometimes they couldn't put it into words, just felt something was wrong. And, you know, so I talked about it in class, and I said, I always felt that was wrong, but I didn't know if I was in Maya. And that made me realize that even a new devotee can understand what's wrong, and we shouldn't, I don't want to say brainwash, but we shouldn't create a situation in which instinctively we know what is right and wrong, but we get bamboozled. You know the word bamboozled? Covered over by some preaching that disconnects us from being able to see what's right and wrong. Okay, so now that brings me to what I was talking about before. How do you deal with something that's not right and not get upset about it and even be able to improve it? And my wife's a really good example of this. And I don't know, I think it's just her nature, but ever since I've known her, we have had many discussions about things which are good and bad in ISKCON, and things which are good and bad in individuals' style of leading and teaching and whatever they do. And these discussions were not discussions to criticize anybody. They were just like an analysis, like you would have, like we would have in Soul Tools, like, well, this is good and this isn't good and we can improve this and this is bad and that presentation this devotee did was good but this presentation could have been better. It was like that. There was no emotion involved. So we'd have a million discussions like that, but sometimes when we have these discussions, some things would really upset me. Like, how can the movement allow this to go on? And how can they allow this devotee to be in charge? And this devotee is harming other people, and this person's life was damaged. I get sometimes extremely frustrated, and it verges on the point where I have to just stop myself, because if I don't, I'm going to get really critical. Because I see a situation where people have been hurt, and it really bothers me when devotees are hurt, because it's unnecessary. We shouldn't be hurting anybody in the name of trying to spread Krishna consciousness. But one thing I notice about her, she could even be more critical than me, but completely neutral. Like, there's no negative emotion in her. There's no anger in her. She's just saying, yeah, this devotee, well, that's how they are, you know, what can you expect, you know, this, that, and the next thing. But it doesn't affect her. She's got no anger in her. There's no anger, there's no envy. She's not upset. That's very interesting how she can do that. And sometimes if you heard her say something and you didn't know her, you would think, wow, she's really critical. But all she's doing is observing in a very aloof way, and just kind of as a professor might observe history, you know, just like looking at it. Well, that's because he's like this, and that's because she likes like that. And that's because in ISKCON they teach this, because they always understood it this way, but they don't understand this side of it, and so they, and then he's a new devotee, and some, you know, so she's analyzing it like a professor. And so we have these, you know, we have these like discussions where we can look at things, but she's, there's no enmity. And I think, I think this is really important, because if you stay in ISKCON, you're going to see things that are not perfect, and you're going to see things that could be extremely upsetting, and you're going to see things that could cause you to be extremely critical, or you're going to see things that'll just make you think, how are we allowing this to go on? I would never do that personally. Or we're going to see things that could cause us to become critical or offensive. And so Premanjali and I, Premanjali went through a difficult situation where a devotee was acting not like a devotee. As we know, sometimes people will dress like devotees or profess to be devotees, but in their private light, like if you didn't know they were a devotee and you looked at their private, if you didn't know who they were and you looked at their private life, there'd be no or little indication that they were devotees, or indication that they're not devotees, unfortunately. I mean, this is a reality, right? So, I mean, I know devotees who previously were involved in the seva of doing illegal activities to obtain money. And they would, I don't want to say what they did, but I will just say that they severely mistreated people in order to get money. And you would ask, how do devotees do that? And the answer is no. So these things go on. And, you know, there's so many things we do, we say, that are not indicative of devotees, how devotees act. Correct? So we were talking about this, and I was saying there's two problems I see. The first problem I mentioned is becoming critical, but there's another problem. Another problem is not seeing the problem, because you think, well, maybe I'm in Maya and it's not like that. And that may be true, but a lot of times it's not true. And you're afraid to see it because you think, if I see it, I'm being critical. And I think we need to learn to have a position in where you can see a problem objectively and be like my wife and just notice and say, yeah, I think this is a problem and I think something should be done, without blaspheming ISKCON, blaspheming leaders, blaspheming every other devotee that thinks that there's nothing wrong or even thinks that it's good. You understand what I'm saying? The other side of that is you don't even notice it, because you're just this ultimate optimist. Everything's good, everything's fine, everything's great. But at the same time, it's not actually great. Things are going wrong and we need to deal with it, right? Just like we can look at the preaching and go, everything's great, everything's wonderful. But as preachers, we want to do better. We say, no, we can do it better. We can do more. Yeah, it's good, but we could do better. And we see here there are programs which could be better if we just did it this way or that way. Not enough people are coming. We're not getting a certain class of people. So it doesn't mean that all the preaching is bad, but it means there's limitations on it. So we can look at those limitations and say, there are limitations. We need to do better. We can think in better ways. We can make better plans without becoming critical of the devotees who are doing this other kind of preaching. Because we need to be critical, we need to be self-critical without being offensive, right? Because no organization can grow if they're not self-critical. No individual can grow if they're not self-critical. It's the same thing. We need to be critical of ourselves without becoming depressed or sad, right? You understand? Because if you're not self-critical, if it's just, I'm great, I'm happy, everything's fine, well, what if everything isn't fine and you need to improve? So you have to be able to improve without being depressed. You have to be able to notice what's going on without being depressed. Right? So the same way, we have to be honest enough to look at a situation within our movement, within our organization, whatever our department, whatever we're doing, and if something is wrong, say, okay, it's wrong. We need, this is not right, we need to change it, or it could be extremely bad, and we might say, this is, we cannot tolerate this, without becoming offensive to the person that we see as the cause, or the group of people, devotees, that is the cause of this. Because if we're so concerned about being optimistic and not offensive, we won't allow ourselves to see what's wrong. And then we'll get more devotees who are saying, I always knew in my gut and my instinct it was wrong, but I just felt if I said, you know, I really, maybe there was something wrong with me. And okay, there may be something wrong with us sometimes when we see something wrong. That's always possible. But it's not always true. And so I think we need, you know, we don't want to leave ISKCON. Prabhupada didn't want us to leave ISKCON, but we don't want to be blind. If there's a problem, we want to deal with it. We don't want to say there's not a problem. We don't want to be these blind optimists that everything's great and don't say anything bad. I mean, in a sense, we want to be optimistic and positive, of course, but not to the point where we deny problems and we therefore deny, or therefore we don't take solutions to the problems. But we want to be able to see it and see, okay, what this devotee did was not right. But I love him, he's a wonderful devotee, but this has to be corrected. We have to be able to do that. It's not easy because that devotee that did something wrong may be a senior, and he won't like it if you tell him. And if you tell the GBC and the GBC talks to him, he's going to realize you spoke to the GBC and he may never speak to you again. You know, there's so many complications in human relationships. But as far as is possible, even in your own life, if you can't do anything, at least recognize, if you can recognize that what this devotee did or what's going on here, it's not right because some people are being harmed or the preaching is not succeeding as it could. At least get to the point where you can recognize this, at the same time be cooperative, not offensive, not negative, not lose your energy. You understand what I'm saying? It's not that to be enthusiastic you don't see anything negative. It's just you see it, but it doesn't affect you negatively. You don't want to be blind to what's wrong. And I think a lot of these people who turned against ISKCON kind of were like that, and then they started seeing, and it was like a phew. It was like leaders didn't want them to see what was wrong, and then they finally saw what was wrong, and they felt cheated to some degree. You painted a picture there was nothing wrong, but there was, and you didn't do anything, and so on. So I hope that's clear. I think it's important for us, because you're always going to see things wrong, and there's always the possibility that when you see things wrong, you're going to make offenses, and there's always a possibility when you see things wrong, you're going to become discouraged. Whereas if you do like more like what my wife does, it's like you have your own life, you have your own service, you have your own sadhana. Now you see something wrong, it doesn't come into your life to bring you down. It's just you've noticed that this is wrong. And sometimes she'll even laugh about it, you know, say, of course, you know, that's why. Because of this, because of this, because of this, it can only be this way. And that's just how things are now, or that's how people think, or that's how this segment of devotees think. You know, just like you may be someone may be very frustrated or angry even, or extremely upset that today in 2014 in the modern world where there are female gurus who are extremely popular in India, that the Hare Krishna movement has no female gurus. And it could make you really frustrated and say, you know, what's the future of ISKCON? You know, the world, you know, the difference between men and women used to be like this. Now in the world, it's like this. In some countries, the women even have more power. And in ISKCON, it's like this. So you could be very frustrated, right? Or you could think, no, the women should not have that position. This is perfect. And you're extremely frustrated with the people who say women should be gurus because that's not, you know, only rare women could do it, and it's not what we should do, etc., etc. So you, when you're dealing with this, you just recognize there are some people who are liberal. There are some people who are conservative. It's their nature. And naturally, they're going to have these very conservative views or very liberal views or whatever views they have. And so you have your views, you disagree with the other side, but you don't go crazy and start hating all the people who don't agree with you and think, these guys, they're going to ruin ISKCON, they're so conservative, they're so liberal. You understand it the way you understand it. You live your life according to your understanding. You understand why other people think that way. It's their, that's how they see the world. You understand, even if you don't agree, these are their arguments, why they're coming. They're coming from, they want to establish a very Vedic perspective. They think that if we become too liberal, it'll ruin the movement. The other liberal people think if you establish too Vedic a perspective, it's too conservative and limited. That'll ruin the movement. It's not what Prabhupada wanted. It's not practical and so forth. So you understand this, but you don't become offensive. And that way, you can maintain your ability to discriminate according to what you believe is right and wrong without making offenses. And then the other thing is that you always have to be careful when you understand a situation to realize that you may not understand it completely, and sometimes you actually may be wrong. So you don't want to get on the bandwagon or the podium and go, this is how it is, this is how it is, you know, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is bad, he's wrong, he's wrong. Only to have to eat your words later to realize you didn't understand the situation. So sometimes, as devotees, we have to say, I'm looking at a situation here, it doesn't appear to be right, or it appears we can do better. This is what I'm thinking, this is what I'm feeling, this is how I'm seeing. Let me discuss this with other devotees. What do you think? Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. That's a nice way to approach it. It seems to be right, we're going in this direction. The temple's going in this direction. It seems to have limitations according to me. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. Let me see, let me try preaching this way. Let's see what happens. I think that's the humble way of doing it, so that we can move ahead according to what we think is right. And then you have to also determine how you want to live. You may look at the lifestyles, different lifestyles you could live in Krishna consciousness. And you could say, this lifestyle works for me. I don't know if I can live in the ashram. I need to have an apartment outside. I need to do this. I can't do that. Okay, this seems to work for me. Other people may do something else. I don't want to say they're bad or wrong. Or I might say, well, they're doing something else, but in 3 years, they're going to end up like me, and they're going to run out of the ashram completely frustrated and, you know, 30 years old and not married. That may be true. And certainly, you're going to make a decision based on your experience. But we always have to think, okay, this is what works for me. Maybe for someone else, it's fine. Maybe for someone else, you see, they're in my situation. I can relate to them. I want to talk to them and just say, you know, I was in your situation. Do you feel this way? Are you thinking like this? They might say, no, I don't. I say, okay, fine. You know, you're good. They might say, yes, I am. And then you talk to them and say, I was also feeling this way. Maybe you need to consider these things. But you always do it in a way that you're open to realize or understand you may not be correct, but it only may be that it's correct for you. It's not correct for everybody. Or it may not even be correct for you and you think it is, and someday you'll learn that it was wrong. So I think the whole point that I'm making here is that I think it's unhealthy for devotees to suppress things that they see. They see something. This is, you know, I don't feel this is right. You know, sometimes, like I say, you see it with your eyes. Sometimes you feel it with your heart. This doesn't feel right. And I was telling you, after Prabhupada left, and then when the gurus took over, we really didn't understand philosophically if there was going to be a difference between how they lived as guru and how Prabhupada lived as guru, and really what it all meant. We weren't clear on that. We only had a philosophical understanding of guru as a general principle, but we didn't understand practically how that manifests in terms of guru-disciple etiquette, god-brother etiquette, and so on. So we put the gurus on big seats. They were maybe this much lower than Prabhupada's in the same width and depth. So just these big Vyasasanas. And we didn't really know what we were doing. We just thought, well, that's what we should do because that's how we worship Prabhupada, and here's a guru. And Guru is Guru, so worship him like Prabhupada. And so you may remember that I said, when the first time I saw my godbrother on that seat, and what that seat meant was, we're on the floor, he's on that seat. It meant he's in an exalted position above us. It was the obvious statement that this person is now different from everyone else. When I saw that, I, in my heart, I was feeling, this was not coming in my head, I was feeling, he's not different than us. He's, you know, last week, you know, I was in his office, you know, telling him he's an idiot because he said this and that. And I told him he was an idiot for the last 10 years, and he told me I was an idiot. And we also joked and wrestled and laughed and did stupid things. And so that, then all of a sudden, that person, who was like all our other godbrothers, is on a big seat. And it's obvious now we're on different levels. He's on a different level from everybody. That's the statement of it. And I just saw that and I said, and I felt, I said, this feels wrong. There's nothing in my head. It was all feeling. So sometimes you're going to be in a situation, you're going to look at something and you don't understand it philosophically, but you're just going to feel, you're going to feel it as if this isn't right. This does not feel right. And so the point of this lecture is that I don't think it's healthy to deny that. And I think it's healthy to observe it without becoming offensive. And you could be, that feeling could be misleading you, but generally it isn't. And you may need to discuss that with other people, you may need to process it, but don't become offensive. Don't become offensive on one hand, and don't deny your feelings and your vision and your sense of what's right and wrong. Because even though you're not, you haven't been in Krishna consciousness a long time, there's some things that are just wrong that anybody will know is wrong, even they're not devotees. I said, why are they doing that? That's not right. So we're trying to stay in ISKCON and work with it and improve it and be self-critical and make it better. And at the same time, not be critical of devotees, because as we're saying, critical of ISKCON means critical of devotees, means ultimately you're critical of Prabhupada. And it's a matter of time before, in the name of service to Prabhupada, you end up criticizing him and you don't even realize it because it's subtle. So, that's what I wanted to say. I think it's, I don't know if this relates, if this helps you or not, but it's just something that I see as a problem, that people have become, they become alienated from their own feeling and their own ability to be objective because they're afraid they'll be offensive, or they're afraid they're not, what they're seeing is not true. But, you know, you're all like mature, intelligent people. And it's really wrong if we in any way train you in a way that you're afraid to use your intelligence and you're afraid to listen to your own gut instinct because you feel, well, I don't know that much and my guru knows everything and I'll just ask him, you know, what do you think about this? And sometimes they would ask Prabhupada, what do you, you know, how do we do this? And Prabhupada would say, well, how do you think we should do it? So a lot of times, you know, a leader or a spiritual master just wants a devotee to start reasoning and thinking. And my personal experience, because I'm older than a lot of you, is that as you grow, you just gain maturity. And it's not only spiritual maturity, it's material maturity. And as you grow, you understand things. Just like Venurati and Atmananda, they're older. They understand things that they didn't understand when they were 20. Now they're 30s, 40s. They just understand. And it's not about necessarily about Krishna consciousness. It's about life. And so, you know, they may come into a temple and it's being run by people that are younger than them. And those people understand life differently. And they'll see some things. And they'll think, that's not right. That shouldn't. This isn't good. That's natural. It's going to happen. And it's not bad. It doesn't mean they're offensive. It just means they're seeing something. And either they're going to detach and just say, okay, that's the way the temple does, or they're going to say, let's try to make it better. Or they might say, hey, I want to give a class to all the, Venerati may say, I want to give a class to all the Brahmacharinis just to let them know what, you know, stages you go through as a Brahmacharini and frustrations and points you may hit. You know, whatever it is, you're doing, you want to contribute. You want to help. You don't want to become offensive because this temple or this department or this leader is not doing what you feel they should be doing, what a Vaishnava should do. And you'll naturally get a lot of that. because we're not perfect. Okay, so now questions, comments. Yeah, I don't know. I think this is really important because it really bothers me when if we train devotees in a way that they can't even hear their own gut instinct. And so many devotees have told me they did something against their gut instinct for which they regretted it. They've regretted their whole life because there was pressure in ISKCON to conform to something. And it was an immature pressure. The devotees who were putting on this pressure didn't fully understand the philosophy, didn't understand it in the practical implications, and didn't understand it from a psychological perspective of how it would affect this devotee. And that devotee being submissive, as we should be, as we're trained to be, to follow our authorities, went along. And I'm not saying not to follow authorities, but I'm saying sometimes you'll just see something and say, no, this is wrong. And you have to say, I can't do this. I don't agree with this. We used to ask devotees to do things that were not entirely ethical. And some devotees wouldn't do them. They'd just say, I can't do that. And so any good leader, you know, when they did unethical things, we're talking about fundraising, which was not 100% straightforward. And because the temples were financially depressed and in difficulty, so they would sometimes devotees would maybe stretch the truth a little bit to raise money. And some devotees would say, you know, if you didn't do that, some devotees would say, you know, you're not surrendered, you know, do whatever you have to do for Krishna, don't be attached and like that. And some devotees would say, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't think we need to do that. I don't feel right. And so, okay, you know, that's how you feel. And so sometimes you have to go with that feeling. And then later on, everybody realized that it was wrong. And the devotees who were considered neophytes or not surrendered ended up being the ones who were right all along. And this happens so many times in ISKCON. The ones who were condemned, you know, it's the Nelson Mandela syndrome, you know. The one who's going to become the hero is put in jail. So sometimes that happens. So I think you understand what I'm saying. I mean, every situation is different. Maybe I'm over-exaggerating it. But so Belen asks her question. What happens with those devotees who are not in ISKCON for any reason, but theoretically they follow Prabhupada? Because maybe they don't criticize, but if they deny ISKCON, they deny Prabhupada also. Not necessarily. You can be outside of ISKCON and not deny Prabhupada, and there's different ways you can do that. And I would say, I mean, anyone is a good devotee. Good devotee means they're following Prabhupada's instructions. They're just not following the instruction to be in ISKCON, but they're, you know, they're chanting their rounds, they have deities at home and so on. So Prabhupada allowed that because he recognized that some people couldn't work within ISKCON. So one time Prabhupada said, well, ISKCON is wherever there are a few devotees chanting Hare Krishna, that's ISKCON. So if you extend your definition of ISKCON to those who are well-wishers of ISKCON but just for some reason can't function within it, which could be their fault or the fault of ISKCON or a combination of both, but are practicing Krishna consciousness, they're not envious, they're nice people, then they get Prabhupada's mercy. You know, if they're initiated by a disciple of Prabhupada and that guru is upset that they're not in ISKCON, that will have some negative ramifications. But still, if they're following the basic rules and regulations, then any guru generally will accept. I mean, there are a few gurus who would reject them. I don't agree they should be rejected. And I don't agree that Prabhupada would reject them. But the highest standard is that Prabhupada would want us to work within ISKCON. That's what he asked us. So and if you can't do that for whatever reason, then you follow Krishna consciousness, you're still following Prabhupada. I mean, let's say you're in a situation, Belen, where you saw something that was very, very wrong and you were trying to fix it and you couldn't fix it. And a lot of devotees were harmed. And you come from a background, let's say you come from a background of people who are very cultured, very well educated, who live with integrity, who are self-reflective people, willing to admit their faults, and people who are really striving to do things right. And then you come into this situation, which is very much the opposite, where people are denying that there's something wrong, and things continue, and there's no system to discuss it, and every time you try to discuss it, you're called envious and so on. And you just come to the point and you say, okay, I'm finished. I can't deal with this. This is wrong. I don't want to be part of an organization like this. This goes so much against my integrity, my values, everything I believe, and this Prabhupada would not want this. And somehow or other, you can't deal with it. You just can't. It's like, you should be more detached, you should be able to help it, you should contribute it in some way, you should, write a paper, go to the GBC, in some way you should solve it. But according to your nature, psychology, the country you're in, the people you're working with, you just can't. Okay, so now what's the problem? The biggest problem is you need sadhu sangha. So Prabhupada would say, no matter how bad things are, stay in ISKCON because you need sangha. But there's this side of you saying, I can't be in an organization that allows this. It goes against my everything I believe. I just can't do it. I feel miserable. I'm having a, depression, nervous breakdown to be able to see this. So that may be true for you, but you say, I know there are many great devotees in ISKCON, and I know there are many great temples and great projects, but here, where I am in this particular situation, this is what I have to deal with. It's driving me crazy. I can't even chant my rounds. I just need to be aloof from this. I just need to have a few friends or devotees, and maybe I go to the Sunday feast once in a while. That's all I can do. So there are people like that, right? And so we could understand and sympathize. Okay. There are people like that. That's just a reality. Okay. So they're chanting their rounds, they have devotee friends. It's just somehow or other, according to their nature, according to what they've been through in ISKCON, they just say, I don't want to be part of an organization like that. Now maybe 20 years later ISKCON changes. There's more integrity, there's more pure devotees and so on, and they come back. That may be. So just it's not black and white. So to say, if you're outside of ISKCON, you're not Krishna conscious. No, if you chant Hare Krishna, you're not envious of devotees. You follow regular principles. You study Prabhupada's books. You try to help other people understand Prabhupada's books. Prabhupada's still pleased with you. He would be more pleased if you could do it within ISKCON. But if you can't, at least don't be critical. That's the message. And so if those people are not critical, everything's good. Now, another thing, Belen, this scenario which I'm describing, it's common that many people go through it. I just went through it, and I don't want to tell you where because it'll be a giveaway, but I went through a situation where what I saw was, it was something that I felt should not be allowed to go on with ISKCON, and I was really upset. I said, how can this be? Why is this being allowed? And nobody's doing anything. It was something that I felt was verging on non-Vaishnava behavior and Vaishnava aparad, many devotees being offended by a leader. And temple, the consciousness of the temple suffering from it. And I think some people, when they saw that, would actually leave ISKCON and say, that's it. I don't want to be part of a movement that allows these things. So we could understand that. A lot of devotees have left that temple and they're very, very frustrated and very, very upset. And some of them are now borderline ISKCON, and it's understandable because they've been through a lot. And other people are doing what Prabhupada would want us to do and just say, okay, that's what's going on here. It's a problem. Let me find service elsewhere. And let me see if somehow or other I can make the situation better. So we have to be able to learn how to do that without being depressed, discouraged, but to go on. That's the ideal standard. And I think that's the basis of what I'm talking about. How to see what's bad, but not yourself become discouraged. But not be blinded, not deny. Because a lot of devotees will deny something's bad because they think, if I don't deny it, I'm being offensive. I'm seeing this, that means I'm offensive. No, sometimes it just means you're actually seeing what's wrong. But you don't have to be offensive because you're seeing what's wrong. Or it doesn't mean you're offensive because you're seeing what's wrong. So being in or outside of ISKCON is not really a criteria for going back to Godhead. It's more a criteria of the best way we can serve Prabhupada. Now, I think I mentioned also There are some devotees who have left ISKCON who I believe are doing better service now than they would in ISKCON because their natures are very, what should we say, maybe out of the box. They think out of the box. They're very independently minded, you know, anarchistic, which is a good quality for Brahmins. It's hard for them to go, like the GBC says, do this, but they don't think it's right. It's like basically impossible for them to do it. They'll just, I'm not going to do that. And they may be right, the GBC may be wrong. But they're not the kinds who'll say, well, I don't agree, but I'll follow because that's the principle that Prabhupada wanted us to work under the GBC. There's some people who just, they can't do that. And so they're actually more successful and they're happier, and probably ISKCON's happier, that they're not in ISKCON, that they have their own organizations because they couldn't work within ISKCON. Now, of course, you could say, well, the best thing would be that they were able to work within ISKCON because they're qualified devotees. They can do fantastic things. That's true. But you understand my point, that some of them, they wouldn't be able to work within the current structure of ISKCON because it didn't give them enough autonomy. And they didn't have the nature with it, in which they could compromise their own principles to submit to another principle that they didn't agree with. And so those people, they either leave ISKCON and start their own organizations, or leave ISKCON and join other organizations, or just leave ISKCON and become, just do their, you know, do their own, have their own life. So I think we have to acknowledge that, and probably ISKCON is happier that they're doing things on their own, because within ISKCON it would create friction. So these are just realities of human psychology. Now, as we said before, there are some devotees who said those devotees should be in ISKCON, but just be sister organizations. So there's a broader ISKCON, and they don't work directly under the GBC, and they're given freedom to do what they want and experiment with different ways of preaching, which may be more out of the box than the GBC would consider proper. But it may open up new avenues of preaching we hadn't considered, and then we in ISKCON will benefit from it and adopt some or all of what they're doing in realization that what they did was good. We're not on that level now. But I think it's important for us to not think that just because someone is not in ISKCON, they're a bad devotee and they don't appreciate Prabhupada. I think what we're concerned with, and Krishna Kirtan said last week, is that a lot of these organizations, if you go there, they'll just try to make you devotees. They'll try to get you away from your guru. They'll try to tell you ISKCON's bad or something. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily going to happen in every organization. And it could happen in the same organization in one temple and not in another. But personally, this is my personal observation, I think most devotees are not mature enough to be able to coexist without that kind of friction of it. You're either in ISKCON or you're out of ISKCON, or either you're in the Gaudiya Math or you're out. And there are devotees that actually like ISKCON and they like the Gaudiya Math and they go to both temples. So, you know, the answer to your question also has to do with individuals, because people function differently. And even those different temples, you'll have different leaders. And some leader of a Gaudiya Math may be very open to ISKCON and say, yeah, come, we can do things together, you know. And others, you'll say, yeah, we can do things together. And when you come, they'll just start preaching to you. You know, in ISKCON, they say this and that, and there's really no pure devotee there, and why don't you stay with it, you know. So that's a problem. So we understand that we want to work within ISKCON, and if you can't work well within ISKCON, find a group within ISKCON that you can work with, that maybe is a little more to the left or the right of ISKCON and you feel more comfortable with. But as far as possible, we want to work within ISKCON because that's Prabhupada's desire. And if for some reason you ever can't work within ISKCON, which I hope would never happen, but still you don't give up your sangha of devotees. You never criticize ISKCON. Don't criticize ISKCON devotees. Now someone might be saying, how could you even talk about ever not being part of ISKCON? Well, I think the reality is a lot of devotees are ISKCON devotees, but they're not ISKCON devotees. If you ask them, are you an ISKCON or not, they say, oh, I don't even know what it means to be an ISKCON or not an ISKCON. They live in their home, they work, You know, they live far from an ISKCON temple. They're gurus in ISKCON, but they're not directly engaged in service. They're just maintaining their families, or, you know, they might tell people in their neighborhood. They might have some kirtan. But they don't even know if they're officially. So I think if you want to define ISKCON, not ISKCON, I would say the broadest definition I could give if you're an ISKCON or not, is that you are a well-wisher of ISKCON. Then in my mind, you're still in ISKCON if you're a well-wisher. Even if you're in the Gaudiya Mutt, you're still a well-wisher. I have friends that are part of the Gaudiya Mutt. And if you met them, you wouldn't know they're not ISKCON devotees. They talk like them, they look like them, they act like them, because they're well-wishers of ISKCON. All their god brothers, god sisters are in ISKCON, or most of them. So it's not black and white. There's so many gray areas. We should always be a well-wisher of ISKCON, no matter what. And you say, Mahatma Prabhu, how could you even talk about being outside of ISKCON? Because it's just a reality that it happens. So why shouldn't we talk about it? See, that's my point. You don't talk about a reality that happens, then how do people deal with it? You know. So if you ever get completely frustrated with something that's going on in your temple, and I can guarantee you, if you live long enough, there's going to be something that's going to completely frustrate you. You're going to see something. Don't leave ISKCON. And if you distance yourself from ISKCON, support ISKCON, be a well-wisher, still serve Prabhupada's mission in some way, somehow or other. So you can be out and in at the same time. I mean, even if we look at Soul Tools is ISKCON, but, you know, we're all devotees, we're all ISKCON devotees. But in a sense, it's got a paradigm which is different from other programs in ISKCON. So it's like we're one and different. We're not outside. And I asked Guru Prasad, I said, you know, you be our GBC and you can be a trustee on the corporation. You know, I don't want this to be outside. But as far as what we do, it's basically we're free to do what we do. So in one sense, it's like our organization functions as if we weren't even in ISKCON. Doesn't it? In a sense. But we're in ISKCON. So, you know, there's so many different ways of dealing with it. And why do we function that way? I can only speak personally. Because I saw things that needed improving, and I wanted to create an organization that established a different standard, that had, in some way, had parameters and values that were harder to develop within the core of ISKCON. And I don't say that as an offensive statement, I just say that as an objective statement, that in trying to establish the values and practices that we do within Soul Tools, in establishing Soul, I wanted to establish something different than I saw going on in ISKCON. I wanted to establish a different culture, and I knew to establish that culture within most ISKCON temples would be an extreme challenge. If I established it within my own organization, it would have a positive effect on ISKCON temples. And they would see, if we're actually successful, if my thinking is right, then they would see, oh, this is a better way of thinking in some ways, in some areas. So, you understand what I'm saying? What I don't think is healthy is that we deal with devotees like they can't think, and we think for them. It's not healthy. We don't want to, we want to help people learn how to think. We want to help people see what's right, what's wrong, and learn how to deal with it without being offensive. So that's my answer to Belen's question. And then Madhava Preeti says, Prabhu, when is the time we can snap and react to an insult to ISKCON or Prabhupada in a nasty way? It's hard to give a general answer because every situation is different. Because sometimes when someone's saying something nasty about ISKCON, they're saying it because they love ISKCON. And so you have to be able to tell. Are they saying it because they love it? Are they saying it because they're personally frustrated and they had such high ideals for ISKCON and now ISKCON is not meeting them? And they're just completely frustrated and what's coming out of their mouth sounds offensive, but really isn't. It's actually coming from concern. So you have to be able to distinguish, you know, what's really going on inside. And if somebody is just, it's just straight blaspheme. Because, see, if you blaspheme ISKCON, that means you can't blaspheme ISKCON without blaspheming the leaders, because leaders are responsible for ISKCON. So whenever you're blaspheming ISKCON, it's always connected to a leader. And I think it's okay if someone blasphemes ISKCON, if somehow or other they can divorce it from the leader. You know, ISKCON, we do this. This is so bad. You know, but they didn't mention anybody's name, or even better, they said we need to improve it. If you want to be a positive force, then if somebody's doing that, just turn around and say, what can we do to make it better? How can you help? What could you do? What do you want to do to make it better? You know, and if they just go on negative, negative, never to be better, everybody's bad, and just say, yeah, I don't want to have this discussion unless you can offer some positive. I'm not denying there's a problem, but if you can't offer a positive solution, there's no point. I don't want to be party to this kind of criticism. And then, so you deal with it that way. So you remove yourself. And if it's affecting the whole community, of course you have to stop it. You know, that we can't allow people to be part of our organization that are going to have ill effects on others. So if they're publicly being critical of devotees, and it's in a way that is extremely disturbing to everyone, of course you have to deal with it. Then it just has to be stopped. Just stop it. But there are positive ways, as I said before, to stop it by asking, what's the solution? What can we do? You're, what you say is right. How can we make it better? What can we do? Let's talk about that. Let's be proactive. Anuradha, how can you know that feeling is real? I mean, that is not your false ego who's criticizing another. So Anuradha is asking a very important question, because I was saying sometimes something doesn't feel right. You just look at a situation and you say it doesn't feel right. And then you think, and then and our, a lot of our training is, well, Prabhu, you shouldn't go on your feelings, because you're just a conditioned soul and your feelings are not necessarily Krishna conscious. I would say, as a principle, that if you're a sincere devotee, generally your gut feeling is coming from Krishna. I would start with that premise. And then the second point I would say is, stand back and see if it's true. In other words, I have this gut feeling that something's wrong. So I'm saying, go with that feeling and see if it's true. In other words, be detached enough that you could be wrong. Maybe your gut feeling is being influenced by false ego. But if you feel strongly about something, if it's just, this is just makes sense to you, this is how you feel this is really right or this is really wrong, and it's a very strong feeling, normally that's Krishna speaking to you. So take it as, I think Krishna's speaking to me. Especially if what he's speaking to, if he's speaking to you, if you think he's speaking to you and you're becoming offensive and blasphemous, okay, he's not speaking to you. That's Maya, for sure. But what may be speaking to you is what you see is wrong, and how you're processing it is just wrong. But aside from that, my personal principle is, if I have some very strong gut feeling about something, a lot of times it just resides in me, and I take it from the gut level to the thinking level, and I just look at it, and I contemplate it, and I observe, is it really like this? Is what I'm feeling really like this? Is this devotee really, is this really bad? And I talk to other devotees, I observe, and a lot of times the gut feeling is true, but I need to refine it, because the details of how it comes out is not true. So what I'm observing in general, it's true, but the ramifications, what I'm observing, or the extent to what I think is true, may not always be true. Does that make sense? In other words, I feel, like we're saying, I feel this is really bad what this devotee's doing. But then I stand back and I say, okay, I'm going to look, I just, this is how I feel, I'm looking at it, all right? Is it really, you know, so days go by, why is he, you know, and then I learn more why he's doing it. I learn situations, I go, oh, actually, it's worse than I thought. Or actually, it's not as bad as I thought. So I kind of, you know, I want to look at my gut feeling and monitor it. I don't want to deny it, because I think that's bad. If we have trained devotees to deny their own instincts, I think we've done a great disservice to them. And I think a lot of those people will end up leaving, because they'll feel that they were in a cult. They will feel that they were not trained to think for themselves. But rather, what I'm saying is, we need to help devotees be able to think for themselves and be able to process their own gut feelings. I think that's really important, like extremely important, because otherwise we're guilty of being a cult. You know, don't think. You know, so then every time you want to think, You ask your guru, how do I think? No, but your guru is trying to help you think. But if you become, you know, it's not that we're not dependent on senior devotees or a guru. Some decisions are difficult to make and are confusing and you really want to know. But other decisions, if you just think about it, you'll understand the answer. But if you're trained in a way to think that you're not smart enough or Krishna conscious enough to have the answer, that's not healthy. Okay, Dustin is saying, it does seem there's a lot of liberal versus conservative views in ISKCON. Is it possible that kind of dialogue can lead to a positive in our preaching? It can, but it can also lead to the opposite. It requires maturity because different points of view, you know, you have a point of view, I have a point of view, we could come up with a third point of view, which neither of us have thought of, if the dialogue is proper. Or we can recognize that some people will share your view, some will share mine, it's a broad movement, and that we need to have a place for both views. Those are mature ways of dealing with it. And so the conservative and liberal can create mature dialogue by which we can grow, or it can create offenses and criticism, which unfortunately it often does. Which is, to me personally, I don't know how you feel, extremely discouraging, because I think it's a weakness and an immaturity that is of fundamental importance to be able to overcome if our movement is going to thrive and survive into the future. Because there are always going to be liberal and conservative elements, and we have to know how to deal with them in a way that both parties are satisfied and we come up with solutions that help the spreading of Krishna consciousness. So the answer is yes, in a healthy environment, it's healthy. In an unhealthy environment, in an immature environment, it becomes unhealthy. And fanaticism, people become fanatical. And then to counteract fanaticism, there becomes criticism. And then the fanatical people become critical. It can verge on fanaticism, which is my way or the highway. I'm the one who's right, you're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about, you're ruining the movement. Both parties are sincere devotees trying to serve Prabhupada. And so, if the movement is to be healthy, then we're going to have to come to a more mature level. I was having a realization here, which was very scary. I said, I think the leaders, and we can do this anywhere, I think the leaders should sit down and say, based on how we think and the programs we have in place now, let us look at where we will be in 100 years, which could be kind of scary, because you could look at how you're going now and say, based on how we're going now, in 100 years, we may not be any better. We may be worse off, or we may not even have a movement, or we all may be Hindus. So I think it's important to look at our lives and how we're interacting with other devotees and the projects we're working on and the consciousness we're developing amongst ourselves and say, if we go on this way 100 years, how will it look? And if it's going to look better and good, we can say, okay, we're on the right track. Because the Indians, not the Indians from Asia, but American Indians or the indigenous people of Mexico also, will say that you should act now for 6 generations ahead. Because what you're doing will affect 6 generations, like 100 years. What we're doing now will affect people 100 years from now. So we want to live and create programs and projects that will grow the movement. So 100 years from now, we can say, oh yeah, these projects we did have expanded. So this dialogue between conservative and liberal, it needs to mature. Because if it doesn't, then if you take that dialogue and multiply 100 years, what do you have? It's pretty obvious. You have all kinds of sects who are extremely conservative, liberal, then the liberals against the liberals. You know what I'm saying? 2,300 sects of Christianity. So that could very likely happen. So I say, what are we going to have 100 years from now? Well, at the rate we're going, we'll probably have 45 Hare Krishna movements. Maybe. Maybe that would be the analysis. But I think it's a great exercise for leadership or even for your own life. The rate I'm going, where will I be 50 years from now, the rate I'm going? Where will my preaching end up 100 years from now? Will it even continue after I die? Will it be good? Will anybody want to take it up? Like Bhaktivinoda did, Namhata was a system that he established that would continue long into the future as a, you know, a functional system to make people Krishna conscious. So we should look at those things. So Venu Abhinanda says, "Wow, Gurudev, thanks a lot for showing us this perspective. I feel that I don't fit in ISKCON as a system, but I want to follow Prabhupada." Yeah, so Venu is a good example. She was living in the ashram, and then she grew out of the ashram. And there are a lot of things that were being preached to her, or paradigms that she grew out. She, you know, when she was younger, maybe it worked. And she might say, well, it never really worked. But I'm sure she appreciates living in the ashram and everything. But, you know, like Venu's ISKCON and not ISKCON. You know, she's with us. Her gurus are in ISKCON, so, you know. So there's an ISKCON beyond what you just see in front of you. There's a broader ISKCON. So we're all part of that because we're all serving Prabhupada. And so if Prabhupada wanted to build a house in which the whole world can live, then we obviously have to broaden the walls, knock some walls down, and build bigger walls. So actually you are in ISKCON. You just may not be in the ISKCON that you used to be in. But wherever devotees are chanting and serving Prabhupada, that's ISKCON. So Anuradha says, Parameshwari says that you're going to be the guru who's going to make disciples who leave ISKCON to come back. We'll get the people to come back. Well, that would be nice if I could do that service. I would love to. Thank you, Parameshwari. So Dustin continues, like if both the liberal and conservative sides are able to be objective, like you're mentioning, to adapt and update our preaching for newer age, yeah. You could say what's healthy, you know, what's a healthy dynamic between liberal and conservative, and what's unhealthy. In a healthy dynamic, people are inspired by one another, they see different points of views, and they realize, there is a conservative element in the world, and that element needs to be addressed. And there is a liberal element in the world, and that element needs to be addressed, and they can both be. There's dangers on either side. You know, you might say, well, you know, if it's conservative, it's safe, because it'll stick more to tradition. Yeah, but Prabhupada didn't exactly stick 100% to tradition. He adjusted the tradition so that people would become Krishna conscious. So there's the problem that you can stick so much to tradition that it limits the amount of people who can relate in 2014 to that tradition. So Prabhupada made adjustments so people could adapt Krishna consciousness. But you don't want to give up tradition. You don't, you know, there's standards that Prabhupada set, and you can't break them. So, and then, if you're, and then, you need to be liberal, as we're saying, so that you can engage more people who could be Krishna conscious, who won't feel that they can't fit in, that it's too ritualistic, that it's just an Indian religion, you have to be Hindu. But then, you can go too far and water it down, so then you're not giving them. You know, you attract all these people, everything's lovey-dovey, but then when you actually look at it, nobody's really becoming Krishna conscious. So that's the fear of being too liberal. So they need, liberal and conservative need one another to create a healthy balance in which you have both elements that work in an integrated way. Whether we can come to that now or in the future or ever, that's another question. But we need to come to that. And I think what we're doing in Soul Tools, you're going to find more devotees. Maybe they're already doing it. They're going to understand that, okay, here are problems in ISKCON which are very deeply ingrained in certain people's minds or temples or programs that can't really be changed, but you want to do something better. So you do, as Prabhupada said, then show by example, do it better. So you get a few devotees and say, let's try to do it better. Now, Prabhupada always said that. And we try to do something better, and we don't criticize anyone else. We say, well, let's try this. I don't see this working, let's try this. So that way you can stay within ISKCON, you can be your liberal or conservative, whatever, without criticizing others, and do what you think is right. So you do your You do what you believe to be, whether you're conservative or liberal, you do what you think is healthy. Now let's see what happens. If you can't amalgamate your ideas with the other side well, then you have to, you know, proceed with what you believe. But don't do it in a way that you make people feel that you're wrong because you're not liberal, or you're wrong because you're conservative. That's not good. And Alexa says this is the healthiest form of relationship, but I don't know what we're referring to. Okay, Prem Pishore says, can there exist a healthy ISKCON Krishna conscious community without a temple? Do you mean without a physical building where people come together with deities and kirtan? Or do you mean outside of ISKCON? Oh, well, you said in ISKCON healthy. I think what you mean is without an official ISKCON temple. Yeah, there are communities like that where devotees just bought land and they built a temple. And it's just grihastas. So yeah, if they're good devotees, it can exist. But I think one of the challenges you find is when you have communities, well, there's a few communities like that. It's a leadership issue because everybody came together kind of on equal level. And so it doesn't function as in an authority structure of ISKCON. And to get anything done, you need some kind of authority. So that becomes a challenge. It's like, it's too democratic. There's no leaders. So you could be challenged that way. But there are communities that are working well. But I think the communities that have leadership, strong leadership, work better. But then that means people have to like the leader and be able to work with him. So, anyway, as you can see, Prem Pishore, it depends on the individuals, you know. And what I'm trying to relate to all of you is my experience of seeing the good and seeing the bad. And when the good is going, it just gets better. And when things are good, when things are right, you just feel good and you feel right. And you say, yeah, this is right. This is working. This is the way it should be. And when things are bad, then people are discouraged. They're critical. They're depressed. They can feel things aren't going well. This is, you know, the future doesn't look bright. And there are reasons why things work well and there are reasons why things don't work well. And I just think it's important to be clear that as devotees, it's really important that we have to be able to overcome the problem of not being able to be mature and broad-minded and accommodating. And I think that's where the problem lies. You know, sometimes we're just very black and white, we're very small-minded. And you can't have a house and the whole world's going to live if you're like that. And we have to be more accommodating without compromising. And that means we as individuals, we have to be extremely mature. And the reason I'm saying this is because I see what I would call immaturity going on. And I call immaturity as a kind of extreme narrow-mindedness to one view. And things can't grow in an environment like that. And so we have to be more open and more willing to compromise and work together and very introspective. And very introspective about the organization, not just ourselves, of where our faults are. And I think that creates a healthy dynamic where we can be extremely successful. And I think if we don't do that, our success is going to be... We can be successful, but there's going to be limitations, and there's a lot of people who are not going to participate. They just won't fit in. And that's my concern, that we need to be able to fit in as many different kinds of devotees as possible and have a place for them. And we need to be able to... Everyone needs to be encouraged. And we need to be able to overcome this tendency to be judgmental, to look at others and say, well, you're not up to the standard, and this is the standard, and start putting people down. And because I don't think our consciousness can thrive in an environment where we're constantly being judged and criticized. I think it thrives in an opposite environment where we're being appreciated and we're being encouraged. And so judgmental and being judged and being criticized is really the opposite of that. And it just, you can't grow in that environment. And if there's too much of that, then you won't be successful. You won't be healthy. It's that people won't be operating with full enthusiasm. And then so many people won't even become part of the organization. Or people who do become part of it won't stay. Because you can't thrive in that environment. So you thrive when we get beyond this judgment and criticism, and we're all in the mood of encouraging one another. Even if what you do is not perfect and you can do better, but we're still in the mood of where we're not judging, we're appreciating, we're just working together out of concern to help people. And that's what's important. It's not whether you succeed or I succeed, but that we help people. Whoever succeeds. Then I think we're going to have a thriving organization. And the other thing, as you all well know, because I've talked about this before, is that if you create that culture, then when new people come in, they also adopt that way of thinking. But if you don't have it, then you run the risk that when new people come in, that they won't think that way. Because conditioned souls generally are judgmental and critical. And so if we have a judgmental and critical environment, then when people come in, it will foster that tendency they have. So we want to create an environment which doesn't foster conditioned tendencies. Right? That's really important. And so even though you may have those tendencies, if you come into an environment within an organization where that just doesn't go on, it's not allowed. People are trained to not be judging. They're trained to be appreciating, showing affection, kindness, and the kinds of characters and virtues that exist in good and healthy relationships and dynamics within organization, then the people who come in will be purified of any negative tendencies. And if they're extremely negative, they won't fit in the organization, and they'll feel it, and everyone will feel it. I don't think that you should be, you know, within the center core of the organization, because you just don't fit in. It's not the way we think. And so you can't allow negativity to arise. But if you're not careful, there are many, many people who are good devotees who by nature are extremely critical and negative. And we're dealing with this all the time, and it's unhealthy. So that's why I'm talking about this. I don't know if that answers your question, Prem Kishore. Official temple, yeah. Since you're talking about soul tools, can you tell us briefly before you sign off your dream for soul tools? Well, if I could paint any picture for soul tools, the ultimate, well, there was, the first dream was that it would attract a broader demographic of people, not just people who would go to a Hare Krishna temple, but it would attract people who are interested in spirituality in general, or people who are pious. So I think we know that. I think that was obvious. And then we would have centers like every, say in Mexico City, let's say like every 5 miles there'd be another center, you know, wherever, or every 10 miles, wherever there's a population area of like, you know, so many hundreds of thousands. And say we need a center for every, you know, it would just be like a friend, like, you know, how many McDonald's are there in Mexico City? Well, you know, something like that. That we would have many centers so that people in different parts of the city could access with a variety of courses. So it would be an educational, primarily an educational institution. But in those centers, there would be kirtan, you know, there'd be support, and then perhaps there would be ashrams. We would have to see, but there would be ashram. But my ultimate desire would be that we all lived in a community, so that everyone who was working with soul tools, we lived, let's say, an hour outside of the city on land, and we all worked together. And if we had an ashram for brahmacharis or women, it would be out there. And we wouldn't have to live within the city. We wouldn't have to work at anything else other than preaching. So the dream is we're all full-time devotees living together in a community, not working in the same company, and the company just keeps growing and growing and growing, and more people come, and anyone we're preaching to or teaching that wants to become a devotee or become involved with soul tools in some way would have the opportunity to live with us provided they follow certain principles. Or we could have an inner group and an outer group. Maybe, you know, and Brahmins used to live around temples and they had outer groups. So, you know, you could have like two plots of land, maybe. The inners and the outer, ones who are more sadhakas and ones who are just want to live within the association. Anyway, that's kind of a broad idea. So, Anuradha, Hare Krishna, Parameshwari says, I'm very happy to listen to your view. Your perspective is very good. Personally, my ashram training was accepted wherever for benefit of my spiritual life and some time put wherever I think I want in a box. Yeah. And I was thinking in a box, only following and not thinking. I'm always thinking, and many devotees think how we can work in a perspective, we can have more communication. Yeah, I think she's just agreeing. It's hard for her to express it in English, but we understand what you're saying. You're agreeing that sometimes, you know, our time in the ashram is very purifying, but it also puts us a little, it can put us in a box. I think I was the last generation to need to accept many things you don't want, but you need to accept for services. For your spiritual benefit, no matter if you are crying every day, if you don't like the saving, you need to do it for help. Fine, it's not healthy, but I need to tell you this happened in the ashram life and still happens. Yeah, I know it happens, and that's why I'm talking about it. So, what we're talking here is a lot about social structure, really. How the social structure affects a devotee's ability to practice Krishna consciousness, you know, I think it's important for us to realize, I think you all realize this, but I want to bring it up just to emphasize it and make it more clear, that our physical state, our emotional state, our mental state, our social condition, meaning our ashram, they all affect our Krishna consciousness. And if any of those are not in order, then it affects us. So when I say social, I mean the interaction we have within our organization, the structures we have, how people are trained, a lot of what we talked about today. If that isn't good, if it's not healthy, then it can create an unhealthy psychology for you. And then you go through what I'm talking about now. You feel guilty, although you see something's wrong, but you feel guilty because you think you shouldn't think that it's wrong, because maybe it's not wrong. But there's a side of you saying it is wrong. And then you get confused. It's an unhealthy state, and that just drains you of energy. You see, the thing is, in a healthy state, then your energy can be used for serving Krishna. So if you're healthy physically, emotionally, psychologically, mentally, and socially, then there's no negatives in your life. Everything's positive, everything's healthy, and then you can just go forward in Krishna consciousness. And I think, at least what my concern is that I don't want to bring people into Krishna consciousness and put them in an environment which is not healthy, because some people come from very stable environments. They have good fathers and mothers. They have good home environments. They had a lot of good friends. And they come to Krishna consciousness, and we don't want them to be in an environment which is unstable, where they're not getting love and affection and care like they got in their own homes, where things are normal as they were. Of course, some of you came from homes which are not normal. So, but I'm talking about people who come from normal environments, right? And so, so it's important. I don't know if this sounds funny, but it's important that things are normal, because, you know, of course, as devotees, we're not that normal. We don't want to be too normal. But you understand what I'm saying? That things are, that your life is normal, you know. And so, it's just as we can say that the first generation of children in our movement were raised by parents who most of the time were doing devotional service, and they were neglecting their children a lot, and they weren't raised in a stable social environment. And a lot of those kids had tremendous difficulty in being Krishna conscious, even though they want to be. They're not emotionally stable as if their parents were always there with them. There was always enough money. They had a nice place to live. A lot of these kids were moving around every year, this temple, that temple, living in a room with their parents, sometimes not knowing where they're going to live, you know. Children need stability and regulation. So it just makes the point that you need all levels of stability to be Krishna conscious. You can't think that you can just be Krishna conscious without it. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote about this in his book, you know, Varnashram, you know. Get it right, your right varna, your right ashram, it creates stability. So you see so many men who aren't married, they're very unstable because they need to be married. Or so many men who got married who shouldn't be married, they're unstable. So you have to, you know, or women also. Or you see women when they're a certain age, they want to get married, and if they're not married, they're unstable. Or you see women in bad relationships with their husband, they're unstable. And so all, or vice versa, men who have a problem with their wives. And it affects their japa, it affects their sadhana. So you need stability and normalcy. So you say, what's your dream of soul tools? Normal. It's normal. People are normal. The organization's normal. And I don't want to mean this as a criticism, but I don't know how to say it any other way. And I think you all know what I'm talking about. And we just want, you know, it's like, you know, Prem Kishore, you are in another organization, and you know that other organization you were in wasn't entirely normal. You know there were dysfunctional things about it. And now you come to ISKCON, and you know there's some things that in that other organization were really good. And there's some things that were really not so functional. And you come to ISKCON and you say, well, there are other things in ISKCON that other organization didn't have that are really good. But there's things in ISKCON that the other organization had that were good that ISKCON doesn't have. They're a little dysfunctional. So we, you know, I mean, what's the mission of Soul Tools? To create a normal environment upon which you can what's the word I'm looking for? You can not grow. What's a better word for grow? Or you can, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, where you can grow very quickly. I can't think of the word, brain dead. My brain's going dead. You know, it was like, you know, create an environment in which you can thrive in Krishna consciousness. That's right. Okay, write that down. This is the mission of Soul Tools, is to create an environment in which people can thrive in Krishna consciousness. That's it. Write it down and send it to me. That's our internal mission, isn't it? And if we do that, we have to do everything I'm talking about in this class. Because if we don't do that, it's not going to thrive. Yeah, you develop your natural abilities. Anyway, that was I think that was a good point. Create an environment in which people can thrive spiritually. And I think that's a good mantra, to thrive spiritually. It's like Bellum was asking me about, well, how do you deal with your parents? And I would say one thing about parents is that they often become the people who help you more than anyone, usually financially, and support you when you have children. So, and that's just normal, because it's normal to have parents and grandparents when you have kids. You can't take care of them yourself. It's normal to have husband and wife when you have kids. So you know, whenever you create something that's normal, then life is easy. When you create things which are not normal, life becomes difficult. So now in our society, you got single parent, you know, women with a couple of kids. That's completely abnormal. And it's totally difficult and practically impossible, and the woman becomes a wreck, right? And you have horrible relationships between men and women, where the men and women are always disturbed and, you know, full of anxiety, and they get diseases because of it, and they're not happy. So even their devotees, and they're chanting Hare Krishna, they're not actually happy. Even they're going to class and everything's blissful, and then they go home and they deal with their husband or wife and they're miserable. So unless you create normalcy, you can't even, you know, Krishna consciousness can't thrive. You know, if you end up a single mother, you're trying to be Krishna conscious, you don't even have time to chant your rounds. You know? So it's like we want to create normal families, normal brahmacharis, normal vanaprasth, normal sannyasis. We don't want sannyasis who 10 years later get married. We don't want brahmacharis who go, you know, run off with a brahmacharini. You know, you want to create, you want to guide people to live normal according to what's real for them. And so normal means we have to be real. We have to acknowledge what's real in us and then live according to what's real. Right? Does that make sense? So, you know, whatever's real for you, that's real for you. And then live that. You'll be okay. Yes? write that down. Help people thrive. I know you may want to throw in the word normal or another word, but I think you understand what I'm saying. It's a really important point. You can't, you're not going to be Krishna conscious. I mean, if you're very, very, very advanced, you could have a horrible life materially, and you could be Krishna conscious. Your home life could be just like a battlefield, but you're so transcendental. You just, you know, you just get up at 2 in the morning, chant your rounds. You don't even care. It's not even what you're looking. You don't care your wife or husband yells at you. You're just so transcendental. It doesn't even bother you. Your kids are non-devotees. It's just, you're so transcendental. You just go off, you know. But how many people are like that? Very few. So it doesn't work normally. So we went too long, right? We went 2 hours. These classes are becoming more like seminars than workshops. But I think it's, these are things that are bubbling over in my head. You see, the thing is, I travel a lot. So because I travel a lot, I see every situation is different, and I see the good and I see the bad. So naturally, I think about this. And because I have disciples and I'm training people and helping people, people come to me with problems. It's usually they're coming to me with problems because their situation is unstable and it's affecting their devotional service. And I do see a lot of temples which are, for lack of a better word, in my mind, in many ways operating abnormally. And it's creating abnormalities for devotees in the temples or around the temples. And how do you know it's creating abnormalities? Because they're upset. When devotees are upset, when they're not happy, that means things are not normal, they're not right. You know what I'm saying? So when you put things right, people become happy, and then they become inspired, and then Krishna consciousness spreads because we're enthused. And you can't spread the movement just because you know that what to do. You have to be enthused, you have to be stable, you have to be happy. Right? And we have to learn how to be healthy individuals who can have healthy relationships with other individuals, because if we don't have healthy relationships, then we're going to disturb the persons we're with, or they're going to disturb us. Right? Okay.